devotional last week, and one of the keynotes and the theme that came out of the keynote was about meeting God in the everyday, the ordinary moments of life, not just the mountaintop moments, not just in the gathered moments where we gather as church together. And you know, it was a big conference. The smoke machines, the lights, everything was there. But there was a lovely emphasis on actually, aren't we all a lot more hungry for meeting God? Not just in those special mountaintop places, but what about the everyday? What about Monday morning? What about the ordinary humdrum of life where decisions are made and things happen and work is done, grandkids are looked after, children are brought up, and can we meet God there? Can we meet him in the ordinary places? And it really resonated with my heart, and our encouragement this morning is James was wanting to speak to his people. We've been in the book of James for a while now. James was wanting to speak to the people under his care about just those sorts of things, that he was wanting to speak to about very ordinary things, particularly in the passage that we're going to be looking at in just a few moments. So maybe God wants to speak to us about some ordinary areas of our lives, the places where we make decisions, the places where we do our planning. And there's plenty of those. We have plenty of choices to make in really quite ordinary ways. And maybe God wants to tell us something about how he wants us to view those. Someone once said this, that we're all theologians. We all have ideas, conscious or subconscious, of who we think God is. And we live in light of such deep-held ideas, whether we realize it or not. You might say you believe in God who is for the outcast, and yet your life may contradict that by your complacency of not really ever caring about the outcast or the marginalized. You may say that you believe God is a God who's providentially caring for the nitty-gritty of our lives in this world and holds them all together, but yet you may live like the opposite is true, that he's not involved in any way. And so James repeatedly, or relentlessly almost, is going after orthopraxy, in other words, right living and right practice in light of orthodoxy, the right belief. He pushes that time and time again. And we want to say to James, I'll show you my faith. I'll show you my faith. I'll show you. And James says, yeah, I want to see how your faith works. I want to see what it looks like in real life. And it's funny. I don't know about you. When you're ever having a conversation with people who maybe aren't familiar or don't come to church, you don't profess faith of any description, often they are interested in what you believe. But more often than not, they're actually trying to, in my experience, they're trying to see, well, how does this faith work? What does this actually look like in practice? Because I don't understand it all, so I want to see it. I want to understand what this actually looks like in your ordinary life. And I think this is the question that James just keeps pushing and pushing. And it's uncomfortable. James just keeps pushing us on the sort of, actually, what does our faith actually look like in practice? So let's read James 4, 13 to 17 together. This is about how we go about planning, deciding, discerning the will of God about the ordinary things in life. Planning, deciding, and discerning the will of God in our ordinary lives. So James 4, 13 to 17. It says, now listen. That was like, listen, really listen. Don't just let it go in one ear out the next. Listen. This is important. Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we'll go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business and make money. Why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it's the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogant schemes, and all such boasting is evil. If anyone then knows the good they ought to do and doesn't do it, it is sin for them. We'll end it there. So last week, I'm going to follow a similar pattern to John, for those of you who were there last week, a similar sense, move from the problem to the solution and really build on the same foundations of what John talked about, but apply it a bit more specifically about this whole thing, about what does it look like to discern the will of God in our ordinary lives? What does it look like to seek the Lord's will in our ordinary lives? And So first of all, we're going to think about trying to diagnose the problem that James is really going after for his people and trying to relate it to some ways we get into difficulties with this whole idea of making decisions, planning our lives, doing what we do most of our time. And I just want to make a slight aside for a minute before we dive into the problem. That is to say, I don't think, and hopefully many of you will be relieved at this point, I don't think James is against planning, right, or making decisions. And I think we can get all sorts of sort of funny ideas about the will of God in our lives. How do we figure this thing out? And from some sort of, we can get magical ideas, like if we just add the phrase, or if we just claim it in the name of Jesus, we can have what we want. And that's just not what we find in the Bible at all. As if we can just utter the words of Jesus and name it and claim it and just take what we want. And that's not how it works. But I think we can also get to the place, and I've experienced this to some degree in how I was brought up, where we can be a little super spiritual about how we make decisions. We almost can't make any decision unless it's written on the sky. It's a direct word of the Lord into our lives. It's as clear as day. And I think sometimes the danger is in that way of thinking. I think the danger is that we view God's will as some sort of tightrope. And I said this before, I think, where God's will is some sort of blueprint and tightrope for our lives, where if we make one decision or make a wrong decision here, go left there instead of a right, oh my goodness, I took this job, not that job, suddenly we fall off the tightrope, we're out of God's will for our lives. And it can be that's a terrifying way to live your life. Because I don't know about you, but God does not always, and I want to say he does sometimes, but God does not always reveal his will in sort of spectacular, Emmaus Road, or just amazing light and just fire and everything, so this is the way of the Lord, walk in. Often you and I are making decisions that are just, we're just kind of making decisions, right? There's nothing, there's no smoke, there's no noises. And so for me, the analogy that's most helpful in thinking about God's will, God has a sort of a will in a sense for our lives, and maybe the boundaries in some sense are his moral will, but the analogy is less helpful of a tightrope and more like an open field to go and explore life, go and take responsibility for life. And yes, there's limits to what God's revealed will is, and sure, he sometimes just interjects specifics into that. But the scary thing for you and I is there's a whole bunch of an open world out there of responsibility where God just says, go into that open field and honor me in that. Make decisions that sometimes I'm just going to ask you to make decisions. I'm not going to spell out blueprint and just go and make decisions. And so some other ways in the way I think that can bottom out, sometimes in a helpful way, sometimes in a not helpful way, is things like, you know, like laying out fleeces and that idea. Have you ever heard about if you lay out the golden fleece and see, you know, as a sort of test to see if this is really of God? Or the open door, closed door thing. How many of you think like, I think like that sometimes, if a door opens or a door closed, that's God's will, it's not God's will. And those things can be helpful, but if they become primary or they can become super spiritual, then what can happen? Like, what would happen if we went with the open door, closed door thing? For example, say your thingy Dyson, is it James Dyson, the guy, the Hoover man? He failed so many times. The door was shut so many times on his plans for the Hoover before he actually hit success and hit the open door of what he left his mark in the world for. Imagine he would just went after the first couple of times and thought, you know what, hit the closed door thing, didn't get anywhere, and was like, okay, I'll just back off. And that's the danger when we take a super spiritual approach to things. If we hit a roadblock in the road and a door closes, okay, the door has closed, and God does guide like that, but sometimes God is asking you to ram it through, push it through, and say, come on, I'm taking, you have to go after some things. And it's also true that sometimes actually he's not saying that. But there's a limit whenever we make that our only and maybe our primary way of figuring out our way in this big bad world. And I don't know about you, but that's a frightening thing in some senses, because particularly now, some of you who are older, I never know how to say it in a polite way, but if you're older and more experienced and at the other end of life, you'll have probably walked that walk a bit little longer and have a few tales to tell and experience under your belt. But I find it a really strange thing whenever I was kind of did that transition from, I think it was university, into suddenly in the working world, because I suddenly realized every decision I had ever made from school, or even as young as before primary school, like, it was all in a sense taken care of. There's this vague idea I was going to go to university, and yes, I had to sort of pick a course and do stuff like that, but the decisions kind of just came at you and things just fell in some way into place. And then suddenly you reach a place in your mid-20s and you're like, things just don't come at you anymore. You have to start making decisions, and there's nobody else there to tell you, go this way, go that way. And the open door, closed door thing sometimes helps, sometimes doesn't. The fleece sometimes helps, sometimes doesn't. And you're left in this place of, oh my goodness, I can just make decisions. And you feel that responsibility, and it can be quite disorientating to know, am I in the will of God? Am I walking in the will of God? Am I serving him, or am I on this tightrope thing where I've suddenly fallen off it? And I found it a really unsettling few years when I started to find my way into this and go, like, it's way more nuanced than just that simplistic, super spiritual way. It's not the magic way. It's not the super spiritual way. And it's also not the stupid way. By that, I just mean sometimes things are just, like, if God has said, do not go, you know, and start up a brothel, you know, that just seems like that's against God's will, right? Hopefully. That's just wrong. So there are some things that are just wrong. Of course, he has revealed that, but there are many things, so don't do that. But there are many things that are morally neutral, and we're left still with decisions to make. So James wasn't against engaging with that, all that, and planning in some senses. So that was all a bit of an aside that took way longer than I planned, but hey, it felt worth it. It felt really good, so I'm glad we did it. So the problem in this passage is I think James's background concern, and has been in the passage before and also the passage afterwards in chapter 5, begins with those in his congregation with money and prestige. And I think the allusion in this passage is really, or the connection is really with that, is there's something about his concern about money and prestige and power, as it were, is very much connected to a false and dangerous, maybe even delusional sense of autonomy. There's a connection he makes with those people who he warns, the rich, and he's warned them before, listen, you who are rich, is there's a connection between being in a powerful, wealthy position with being in a position of, I guess, self-autonomy. And this manifests in this passage in the language that that James describes, because he goes on and he says, as it is, your boast is, his problem isn't their planning, it's their arrogant schemes, it's their attitude about their planning. And this comes out in the language of, tomorrow we will go here, we will do that. And most translations just kind of collapse all those, we will go here, city, and spend time here into one. But the Greek, I think, parses it out a wee bit more, and it emphasizes that we will go. It's this future tense that it's a certain, we will do this, we will go there, we will do that. We'll spend time here, we will make money, we will do. And it's all this idea of, we are in charge of our own life, thank you very much. I am going to do what I want with my life, thank you very much. And I am going to, and so James just, that's the sort of thing. And James says, that's boasting. That's arrogant. And it's evil. And it's sinful. And so the arrow, if James is trying to diagnose the heart of the problem, it's not any of this sort of discerning, making decisions and trying to figure out what might be the best thing to do in a situation and making sensible plans. So all you planners, are you, what is it, J's and Myers-Briggs, JMP, the J people who are just like, everything planned out. James is not against you. He likes you. He probably thinks you're a wonderful person, and those people who are sort of the other end of the Myers-Briggs spectrum who are just spontaneous and laid back, you know, we're all different. James is not really ruling any in or any out, but he is lining up an arrow going after those who've become inflated and secure in their wealth, and it's led to the age-old problem of choosing to live life with wisdom from below. Selfish ambition. I am going to live for myself, what I want, And it's my way or the highway. And the functional lord of their life in James's community was their money and their power and their wish list of their things they just wanted to do. And hence John had this lovely picture of the hedonist wine. You just check back to last week when it comes on the sermon. Is this idea that, that will make no sense to some people who weren't here last week, I apologize. But is this idea that just the highest thing is just what I want, what my money can buy me. That was the functional lord of what was going on. And James was going after that. He's going after that mindset and he's going after that attitude. And he's like, do you know what? That's just not Christian. That's boasting. That's arrogant. And many people do that. That self-autonomy thing. But that's just not Christian. In fact, let me call it something. Let me call it sin. It's sin. It's just living your life the way you want to live it. And it's made me think a wee bit, well, what is that our problem? I mean, if he's going after people with that sort of power and money and able to control and make choices, I don't know, but when I sort of thinking about it this week, how much choice, in our culture, in Western society, how much choice, how many choices do we have? They're endless. They're absolutely endless. Maybe they'll come up in the screen, but we choose where we live. We choose, or is there a problem? There is a problem. We choose where we live. We choose what we want to eat. We choose what supermarkets we go to. We choose what schools we will send our children to. We have so many choices to make. We have so much power. We have so much prestige. We have so much, to be thankful for, but there's so much that I think can become a slippery slope to just living life in our own terms, living life in our own way. And it's very easy for us to just get comfortable. Just get comfortable with what we have. Just get comfortable to making our own decisions. Just get comfortable with maybe squeezing God out of the equation. Remember the days where you were perhaps pre-mortgage, pre-job, pre-kids, pre-anything responsible. I don't know, for some of you, you can't maybe remember those. You're actually maybe thinking, I'm now post-mortgage, post-kids and post and all that. And that might be your place. But I don't know. I was thinking about those days, you know, before I had a mortgage. I remember the day when I got a mortgage for the first time. And I thought, gosh, wow. That's big, and that's going to take a while to pay off. And then the next thing was a car. Wow, I've got a car. I've got a house. I've got a car. I've got a wife. I've got these, not things. My wife's not a thing. She's a very beautiful, if she is a thing, she's a very beautiful thing, but she's not a thing. She's a person. But I started having these things in my life where I had responsibility, and the days of just being carefree and just being able to think, oh, I'll do this, I'll do that, I'll do whatever I want. And suddenly you have these weighty things in your life that just become, well, they're real. And in many ways, for some of us, they have to be dealt with. Mortgages, you don't have to go down that route, but there's nothing wrong, I don't think, with going down that route of taking on a mortgage. But the danger is in all of these things, they just squeeze God out. From a day where we maybe thought, maybe naively, we're just young and carefree about how we did our life and faith, and we never are going to be those people who just get into a rut and do boring things like have a house and a family and all that boring stuff. And then you do all that amazing stuff, and you just squeeze and get used to making decisions and just squeeze God out of it. And it happens very subtly, little by little. And it's very easy. I remember that. I wish I could remember the fervor of, well, I get this mortgage, well, all that stuff. It was such a big deal. Now I make decisions like that. It struck me we were, this feels like a bit cathartic, but anyway, we're working on our patio and fencing and shed. Really, really important stuff. Just kingdom priorities, patio, shed and garden. And so it's the one thing we hadn't figured out yet in our move to Scotland, and we're getting around to doing that. And do you know, I've just, I've got the bill in for what that, a quote for what that looks like, and suddenly I wish it was a bit handier. I'm rubbish, but now I have to pay a man or two to come in and do all this stuff, and the quote was more than, let's say, I was expecting, but that's not the point, but that's just context. But it just struck me as I was just like kind of clearing and just meandering through that decision, okay, so thinking about this, that, and the other thing, and I just thought, just caught on to myself. Just so potentially complacent about just making it's not a big decision, it's not a world-changing decision, but we just get used to making decisions and squeezing this God who we say we love above all things, His kingdom, His priorities are top in our songs and our worship. And then it comes to the ordinary humdrum of life and making decisions like patios, like the sorts of cars we drive, like the sorts of things we're going to do, the holidays we're going to go on. And do you know something? What happens so easily? God just gets squeezed right out of that. And it just becomes, here's the challenge. It doesn't even register on our conscience a layer of guilt. Where I can remember again the time where the conscience was raised to these things. But see, after you've made so many decisions where you just get very, this is just what we do, right? You compare yourself, you know, we do whatever. I do my wee bit. I've got my money that goes in every month, wherever. And God just gets squeezed out. And my fear is in our choices. That is what very often can happen. And I think the solution, if that's the problem, if that was the problem for James, I think the problem for us is all the more with Netflix, Apple Music, you know, Amazon Prime. How much choice do we have to go after planning our lives away, making decisions? If that was their problem, I think it's to some degree our problem. And the solution, James was saying, was about this wisdom in a sense from above, or it was about leaving space for the will of God. It was about practicing humility. And to get there, James says, so why? You don't even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You're a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it's the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. And so it's a mindset and practices. So I'm going to talk about the mindset, which is more specific, and the practices, which I think will maybe help just think, what does this look like in some situations? But the mindset is this one of humility, and James starts to get there by pointing out the sort of creatureliness of reality of who we are. He compares our lives and his believers' lives to this mist. It's not even a fog. Not even a good, healthy, meaty fog that just lingers for the whole day and you can't, it's like the Aberdeen sort of har that could be there for days upon end. It's not like that. He said it's like this mist, this Palestinian mist that comes in the morning and then the heat comes up, the sun, and it just disappears like that. Boom. And James is starting to say, look, our lives are like that. Our lives are like that mist, that vapor that just disappears when the heat of the sun rises, and our lives can be over in a flash. And he's saying, look, health check, just let me state the obvious to you. That is what our lives are like when you say you go, tomorrow we're going to go this and do this thing or that thing, go to this city, spend this money, do business here. None of those things are bad, but he just says, listen, I don't know about you, if you've, in this line, you get to spend time with people who are either had close encounters, had difficult situations, had bereavement, or had threats to their health. When you speak to people in that rawness of that moment, do you know something? They get that more than the rest of us, who are just going on as per normal. This is just what life's like. This is just what life's like. And then you meet somebody who's just been in that maybe crisis moment. They're painfully aware, sometimes more joyfully, purposely away. They feel awake. They're like, do you know what? I suddenly see my life in a new light. I'm going to live it because tomorrow may never come in some sense. We do not know. And James is saying that's not a bad way to think, because that's humility, because that means you recognize something. You recognize that you are a creature depending upon a creator God. And that is humility. And that is the mindset. That is the heart, that is the way to think about your life. So the mindset is, is incredibly important. If I could sum up the wisdom that I think James talks about throughout the book, I think is a posture of creaturely dependence on the Creator God that manifests in prayer. You can't pinpoint it down to one specific thing or the other, but it begins with a heart, a mindset that knows that your life is dependent upon God. And James helps us to get there by the healthy reminder that you and I, we are like vapor, mist. And so I wanted to also push that a bit further and think, okay, if that's the mindset we are to cultivate, that's the mindset we are to go after in our everyday lives, what's going to look like leaving here? It's going to be like, very good, okay, I'll adopt that mindset. Okay, new mind, off I go. Another week, another, you know, same old, same old. And so I wanted to tease out, look, please don't hear any of these practices as a new law upon the law or legalistic things you have to do. And I'm just trying to think about some practical things that actually, I think, articulate something of what it looks like to have this mindset of humility. So there's seven, and we're just going to rattle through them. Don't worry, it's not a seven-point sermon coming up here. So the first one, I think, that is straight from the text. Some of the rest of them are more by extension of the principle. But the first one that James gives us directly is about the words we say. He says to use language that is provisional and trusting. He said, if it's the Lord's will, say, it doesn't say, don't say tomorrow, God willing, I'm going to France on Wednesday, nobody's stopping me, put it that way. I plan to spend there. But there's something about the language, about how you speak and how you communicate and witness to each other and to others about God and form your own way of thinking. The things, and James says, you should say, instead, I'm going to do this, we're going to do that. He's saying, use language, and it doesn't have to be legalistically, if the Lord wills, and very piously, we're all going to add that into every sentence we use. It's in your own way, in your own language. Use language that is provisional and trusting. And you will develop humility. So use language that's provisional and trusting. The second one is spend time with people older in the faith. My point about the mist and the vapor and the disappearing, do you know, there's an arrogance, I think, that is inherent to some of us of youth. And we think we can change the world. You're like, you're not young anymore. Who are you kidding? But whenever you're 18 to 20, do you know, you're at that stage of life where you're like, do you know, the world's before me. I am going to take on the world. I am going to change the world. I am going to put, the world needs me. And we don't say that, but some of us think that, or am I just confessing out loud? Maybe. But sometimes when we sit down with just people, and this is the beauty about being a church family, when you sit down with people of different age stages of life who have seen it all in many ways, and you listen to their story, you start to get a sense of what it means to follow Jesus, because you hear stories that go like, ah, maybe I'm a bit more like a mist or a vapor than I thought. And so I think spending time with people who are older in the faith. The third thing is share big shifts in direction with a discerning, trusted group of others. Share big shifts in direction in your life with discerning and trusted others. Sometimes it grieves me when we don't do that. When you hear about big decisions. Now, I don't need to know all about big decisions as pastors, but do you know, there's something about humility and wisdom that just says, actually, any big shifts in life, I'm going to make those decisions by sharing them with trusted people who will help discern. And I think that's a posture that says, if the Lord wills, if the Lord wills. Fourthly, don't overlook small decisions. Sometimes it's the little habits we just get, you know, into that we suddenly become a way of existing that is independent from God. Five, so submit your plans that you want to make and decisions you want to make. Submit them to God during and after your planning and deciding. So you decide to do something. You decide, this year I'm going to take this year to do X, Y, and Z. This is what I'm going to do. Submit to God in that before, during, and after. And just hold it. There's a lightness, I think, that we can hold to the decisions we make. Sixthly, run monetary decisions through a serious hermeneutic of suspicion. By that, I just simply mean, when it comes to money, begin with the hypothesis that you could be or you probably are slightly biased, slightly blind. You have slightly more than you probably realize. Begin with a hermeneutic of suspicion when you make decisions about money. Hallelujah. No? Anybody? I just think it's so important to run these monetary decisions through a lens of, well, what might God want? If it's the Lord's will. And then finally, pray and seek to ask the Spirit to guide your conscience as you make decisions. There's no specific practice there in a sense. It's just like, pray. When you pray about these things, do you know something? Attend to your conscience and how you feel, what goes on in your mind. Don't try and stuff that down. Pray. If there's that lightness and saying, look, however you want to lead in my life, pray and listen to that conscience, which the Spirit loves to just get in there and guide you. And so that's seven things, but that I hope can make a difference. Do you know something? I want to just make briefly some connections with the gospel. The gospel, I think, of Jesus Christ refutes arrogance. The original sin, the original problem was this thing in the Garden of Eden where Adam and Eve, they basically chose self, they chose pride, they chose to, God said, don't touch the fruit, and they touched the fruit, they wanted to know and have the sort of autonomy like what God had, and then the boundaries of God weren't enough, and they wanted it their own way, and humans have been making that mistake time and time again, all over, and the gospel refutes and is framed in that story of original sin whereby we choose to live our own way. And the gospel of Jesus Christ refutes arrogance. And the gospel also refutes arrogance by saying we can't find our way back to God. We can't earn our way back to God. We can't do anything to repair that selfish innate thing in our hearts to do and have a heart that beats for God. We can't find a way back. But it says somebody came and blazed the trail back to heaven, back to what it means to be with God. Somebody who came and lived a life and said, Father, not my will be done, your will be done. And that was his life and that was his prayer. He was always about his Father's work. And Jesus Christ lived that life that we could not live in perfect submission and perfect humility to the Father's will. And on the basis of that, offers us that way back to home, that way back to a restored relationship with God. But we can't get there. We can only receive it humbly. We can't get there through our own efforts. And so in all of these things, I think one of the most significant things we can do is just to look a little longer at Jesus. Just look longer at Jesus and who he is. What he's about, his life of devotion to the Father, his life of not serving his own will, but submitting that always to his Father's and saying, not my will, yet yours be done. There's a quote I came across in a book on Christian leadership by a Catholic writer, Henry Nouwen, who's a tremendous writer, and his writing stands in such contrast. I've been to a lot of leadership conferences. If you're in any industry, I'm sure you go to leadership stuff all the time. And to be honest, sometimes it just gets tedious here's the next thing about leadership that looks like this. And I love some of it's really helpful, but some of it is my mind just gets saturated with it. But it just stands in so much contrast to something that Nouwen says in his book on Christian leadership. He says this, maturity is the willingness to be led where you would rather not go. Maturity is the willingness to be led where you would rather not go. And I just thought, isn't that quite challenging? doesn't that sound a wee bit like the way of Christ? Not my will be done, but your will be done. maturity is a willingness to be led where you'd rather not go. So I think the call on our lives is, in some senses, really straightforward. What I think this passage is teaching is that true wisdom is marked by an inherent humility in all of life's decisions that shows an appropriate posture of dependence and love for God in light of all his goodness and in light of Jesus Christ, his fullness of his gospel. He says, I want to encourage you to look at Jesus this morning, who paradoxically gave up everything but restored everything through that. And he asks us of everything, but will give us everything and more than we could ever ask, dream or imagine. And there's that wonderful paradox. And I wonder if at Adelaide Place we have people willing to be disciples like that. I ask myself that question. Am I willing to be the sort of mature disciple who's willing to be led where I would rather not go? Or subtly underneath it all, is it my will? And that's the question that I want to leave us with, finished off with words from James, words from Paul, and words from Jesus. James says, say if it's the Lord's will, we will do this or do that. Paul says in Romans, if I can quote Eugene Peterson's message in Romans 12, so here's what I want you to do, Adelaide Place. God helping you, take your ordinary everyday life, your sleeping, eating, going to work, walking around life, and just place it before God as an offering. And in the words of Jesus, words that should always ring in our heart, not my will be done, but yours. Let's pray together.